For the last 5 centuries, the Western capitalist system has been subjecting most of the world's people to a permanent crisis of endless war, massive poverty, environmental degradation, and economic instability.
Capitalism has been built through slavery, imperialism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. More than 1 billion people have been killed by capitalism, making it the greatest crime committed against humanity.
Lately, this crisis has moved into the centers of capitalist power, North America and Europe. This documentary is about the destructive record of capitalism and the current disasters it has fomented.
You're listening to Capitalism is the Crisis, a 4-part radio documentary series. I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Kristen Schwartz. This is Capitalism is War, the opening episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and show how both stem from the needs of capitalism for resources and markets.
Capitalism has inflicted war on most of humanity for the last 500 years to acquire the world's resources and markets. The establishment of capitalism as a world system by European imperialists has killed more than 1 billion people, most of them in the global south. This Holocaust includes up to 500 million Africans who were eradicated due to the slave trade enforced by Britain, Portugal, and France. 200 million people in India were killed under British colonialism. In the Americas, the genocide of 215 million natives was carried out by Britain, France, Portugal, and Spain.
The First and Second World Wars were wars of intercapitalist rivalry and together killed 107 million people. Since 1945, the United States has dominated the killing, wiping out more than 46 million people in the global south through wars and neocolonialism in order to maintain Western economic dominance. This strategy has failed. In spite of the genocide, the U.S. has declined as an economic power, which has only made it more warlike as it tries to substitute military force for economic prowess. Washington's European partner countries are now following its descent into economic stagnation.
The U.S. and other Western capitalist nations are unable to economically compete with China and India, the rapidly rising Asian capitalist powers, which are acquiring more and more global resources and markets. The Iraq and Afghanistan wars are wars of Western capitalist and imperial decline. The Western capitalist answer to the Asian challenge has been these two wars, both of which are aimed at grabbing by force crucial oil and gas deposits, markets, and military bases in an attempt to impose Western domination on China and India. Similar motives are behind direct and proxy Western attacks on Libya, Syria, Iran, Somalia, Yemen, and Sudan. This attempt at domination has clearly failed as China and India continue to become increasingly powerful.
The major reason for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March 2003 was to get its oil. The genocidal invasion and preceding sanctions killed 3 million Iraqis, including 500,000 children, and totally destroyed a relatively advanced southern country whose people were largely prosperous. 4.7 million Iraqis were displaced by the invasion, out of a population of 31 million. Yanar Mohammed is president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, headquartered in Baghdad, which is aimed at protecting and empowering Iraqi women to resist the capitalist elite created by the U.S. invasion.
The army and the military arsenal, when it went from this side of the world to that side of the world, the intent was to kill, millions of Iraqis, at least hundreds of thousands, and the mission was accomplished. A big number of Iraqi people were killed with no discrimination. Men, women, children, babies, all of us were terrorized, and it got 30 million people also terrorized. So when I think of the history of those years where we lost our security, where we lost our well-being, where we lost our wealth, and we became those of us who managed to stay alive had to travel halfway around the world to find security. I feel that somebody needs to be held accountable. Accountable for making us lose our welfare, accountable for the millions of Iraqis who have been killed, and also accountable for having hundreds of thousands of Iraqis get lost by illnesses and by radiation. I feel that George Bush needs to be to go to court as a criminal of war, not only himself, but all the American presidents who have served during the war on Iraq, because what has happened to us in Iraq is no less than a Holocaust.
The U.S. has withdrawn most of its forces from Iraq, but not all of them. Washington claims that the Iraq war has ended, but this is untrue. The insurgency in Iraq continues, with an average of 95 people being killed every week during 2012. A major bombing or shooting happens about twice a week in the country. 9,000 U.S. mercenaries and hundreds of U.S. troops remain in Iraq, which also has the largest American embassy in the world, staffed with 11,000 personnel. Militarily, the U.S. is still highly involved in Iraq, training its repressive security forces and trying to put more American troops in the country.
Washington has also waged an economic war against Iraq by creating a capitalist elite to rule the country, represented by the puppet government it has installed, which is led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Maliki is a corrupt and brutal dictator and head of an Islamic fundamentalist party. Under U.S. dictates, the Iraqi economy has been privatized, which ensures that Iraqis do not benefit from their resources, especially oil, money from which now goes to U.S. and other multinational corporations and to the Maliki regime.
It is an economic war against the people of Iraq. So first the military machine was taken there and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were killed. But the second step was directed against millions of people, millions of working class, and that was through the economies of improvisation and also of starving the people, giving them salaries that are not enough to put proper meals on the table. They have written the laws. They have created the capitalist ruling class in Iraq to be their partners. The ruling class will make sure, makes sure that the Iraqi people will not get any of the oil, but they will observe their interests inside Iraq. The profits go into the pockets of the Iraqi officials and the British Petroleum and Halliburton and the other companies. So we know that the Iraqi government, which was installed and put in place, are so keen in keeping the U.S. interests in place and in defending them against the welfare of the Iraqi people.
Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. This highly valuable resource has been handed over mainly to the U.S. companies ExxonMobil and Occidental Petroleum, to British Petroleum from England, and to Royal Dutch Shell from Holland and England. Iraq's oil has not yet been formally privatized due to massive public opposition, but a de facto privatization has taken place.
Before the invasion, Iraq's oil had been nationalized for 40 years, and with it, the Iraqi government had created a welfare state for its people, providing them with free education, medical care, subsidies, and a relatively high standard of living. All of these crucial gains have now been wiped out. Saddam Hussein, the ruler of Iraq, hanged by the U.S., was a brutal dictator, but he ensured that Iraq's oil benefited its people. Iraq's current leader, Nouri al-Maliki, is a dictator too, brought to power by the U.S. invasion. But he doesn't provide any economic benefits to the Iraqi people, and instead is involved in looting the country's oil wealth, along with multinational corporations.
There was a state that was taking care of the education of the people, of the health of the people, and there were some socialist economies where the people had some ability to live and to enjoy, let's say, a sort of prosperous life when compared with other parts of the capitalist world. But at this point, all of that is being lost, and it's not again to be granted anymore. We are learning what free enterprise is. We did not have a history with it in Iraq, but we know for sure now that the receiving end, all we see is poverty and inability to complain, and also the government has put in place articles which prevent the organizing of workers and of unionists so as to claim their rights. So they have created an oppressive environment, even more oppressive than what is in the U.S. and in the rest of the Western world. I can speak stories of new phenomena that have started in Iraq that we had not seen in the decades before. For example, we begin to see young girls who are bought and sold in the market for money, bought and sold into the sex industry. We begin to see a very high rate of prostitution in a country where it was not known before as for Iraqi women. So when you look at a big number of the population having to sell their bodies on daily basis to just make ends meet or to feed their babies, it tells you the story of how capitalism has changed our politics in Iraq so as to even change the bodies of women into resources for living for the poor.
The U.S. has long considered Middle Eastern oil a vital economic and military interest, especially since it imports more than half of its oil requirements. State-owned oil companies control 90% of the world's oil reserves, while corporate oil companies control only 4%. With these reserves declining and being subject to competition from the large energy consumers China and India, an economically weakening U.S. has to turn increasingly to military options to ensure its access to oil.
Bush administration officials and U.S. military leaders have admitted that its invasion of Iraq was done to take the country's oil. These men include Paul Wolfowitz, the U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary, General John Abizaid, head of the Pentagon's Central Command, which is focused on the Middle East, Alan Greenspan, chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, and Paul O'Neill, Bush's first Treasury Secretary.
The decision to invade Iraq was made only 1 month after Bush took office in February 2001, according to Ron Susskind. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and the author of a book on Paul O'Neill. O'Neill revealed that days after Bush's inauguration in January 2001, his advisors planned how to invade Iraq and divide up its oil wealth. According to O'Neill, Bush's first National Security Council meeting included a discussion of invading Iraq, and Bush wanted to find a way to do this. There was even a map for Iraq's post-war occupation showing how the country's oil fields would be carved up.
U.S. and other Western oil companies had been shut out of Iraq before the invasion. In 2001, oil company executives encouraged the Bush administration to invade Iraq by warning it in a report that as long as Saddam Hussein was in power, the U.S. would remain, quote, a prisoner of its energy dilemma, suffering on a recurring basis from the negative consequences of sporadic energy shortages. These consequences can include recession, social dislocation of the poorest Americans, and at the extremes, a need for military intervention, unquote. The report called Iraq a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to international markets. The document was compiled by David O'Reilly, chief executive of Chevron Texaco, Luis Giusti, a director of Shell Corporation, and John Manzoni, regional president of British Petroleum.
The oil factor is not just about access, but also about controlling other countries economically and militarily. In the book Resource Wars, Professor Michael T. Clare cites the words of Vice President Dick Cheney in 1990 to explain why the Bush administration invaded Iraq. Whoever controls the flow of Persian Gulf oil has a stranglehold, not only on our economy, but also on that of most of the other nations of the world as well. Clare adds that control over Persian Gulf oil is also consistent with the administration's declared goal of attaining permanent military superiority over all other nations.
Well, we know for sure that the U.S. Government always has a plan to invade a country in the world. And these countries that they want to invade are lined up in order. But we know for sure that the Iraqi spot got priority because of the wealth that was under the ground, and our lives were devastated because of that wealth under the ground. And in our culture, we say that a wealthy land is just like a very beautiful woman who everybody has their eyes on, and she will never live a happy life.
As with Iraq, oil and gas were major factors in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan also. The 12-year-long and continuing Western war in Afghanistan has killed close to 100,000 Afghans directly and indirectly by fostering starvation, disease, displacement, lack of medical treatment, and crime. More than half of Afghanistan's 30 million people live in extreme poverty, and 30,000 children die every year from malnutrition. 132,000 troops from 50 countries occupy Afghanistan, yet after 11 years are unable to beat the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban insurgents.
The The U.S., NATO, and other foreign occupiers have set up a very brutal and extremely corrupt Islamist puppet regime as fundamentalist as the Taliban under President Hamid Karzai, whose government is the biggest heroin trafficker in the world. The country is ruled by criminal Western and Afghan warlords and drug lords, whose forces regularly kill innocent civilians, especially women and children. The Nuremberg Tribunal, set up by the U.S. after World War II to prosecute Nazi war criminals, confirmed that wars of aggression are international crimes. Both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are wars of aggression, making U.S. leaders guilty of genocide and other war crimes similar to those that Washington hanged German leaders for. Not only has the U.S. carried out Hitler's war policy by invading Afghanistan and Iraq, it has used actual Nazis to do so. The Pentagon has knowingly recruited more than 48,000 Nazis, murderers, rapists, and other violent criminals into its army. This has encouraged the many massacres of Afghan and Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops that have occurred.
Manalai Joya was the youngest female member of parliament in Afghanistan before she was expelled from that body for opposing the presence of warlords and drug lords in it. She is a popular women's rights activist and an outspoken critic of the Karzai government. There have been 4 assassination attempts on her life. She also runs a clinic in Farah province, which is the only healthcare center in the area that offers free services to mainly women and children.
That every day they shed the blood of my people. The blood of my people is not water. It's worth as much as the blood of Westerner worth. Today, men and women of my country, both of them do not have liberation at all. Millions of Afghan, they suffer from injustice, insecurity, corruption, joblessness, poverty. To know better about ongoing catastrophic situation of my country, this example also enough that UNDP gave report Afghanistan ranked 181st out of 182 countries. Today, city of Kabul has been changed to the city of beggars and orphans. FAO gave report 18 million people of Afghanistan live on less $2 a day. And media in Afghanistan gave report 2 mothers of my country in Herat and Ghor, they are ready to sell their babies for only $10. Many examples like this that mainstream media never want to give it to you. Now my people is squashed between 2 powerful enemies. From the sky, occupation forces bombing, killing civilians under the name of Taliban, most of the women and children. In the ground, Taliban and warlords continue to their fascism. And then they put the name of that war on terror, which is just war on innocent civilians. As they did bombing in Farah province on May recently this year, more than 150 civilians has been killed, most of them women and children. Maybe you heard a little bit through media. Even they used white phosphorus and cluster bomb. 11 bodies their family still didn't find. They has been cut into pieces.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan partly to control the enormous oil and gas riches of the Central Asia region, which borders the country. One reason for the invasion was the building of a pipeline through Afghanistan that would take natural gas from Turkmenistan to India and Pakistan. Turkmenistan contains the 4th largest reserves of natural gas in the world. The U.S. has been trying to set up the pipeline for a decade, having first negotiated the venture with the Taliban when they were ruling Afghanistan.
At the time, Unocal, a U.S. oil company, wanted to build the pipeline. 2 months after these negotiations broke down, Washington overthrew the Taliban in October 2001 when it invaded Afghanistan. Since then, the U.S. has persuaded India, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan to sign an agreement aimed at constructing the pipeline.
Mike Skinner is a specialist on the subject of the Afghanistan war and capitalism. He is completing a PhD thesis titled International Interventions in the Age of the Empire of Capital, The Case of Afghanistan, at York University in Toronto, Canada. He has traveled to Afghanistan twice for research. According to him, the Turkmenistan pipeline was only one part of the economic rationale for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Washington wishes to dominate the creation of a massive energy-related infrastructure in Eurasia, including Central Asia, China, and South Asia. In the U.S. plan, this infrastructure will consist of railways, roads, electricity projects, several oil and gas pipelines, and mining ventures. Afghanistan is strategically located bordering Central Asia, China, and South Asia. The country is also mineral rich, containing some of the world's biggest copper and iron ore deposits.
Maintaining American primacy is dependent on expanding control in Eurasia. Even on the basis of resource wealth, there's a huge attraction there. But an even greater geo-economic and geostrategic factor is the importance of expanding the networks of transportation, communications, energy transmission throughout Central and South Asia. And connecting China to Europe, connecting India to Russia, this process of infrastructure development is inevitable. Someone is going to do it. We're looking at investments of tens to hundreds of billions of dollars, and return on investment into the trillions of dollars in economic terms, and then in geostrategic terms. If we look through the last several hundred years of history, the empire that rules is the empire that is both the builder of this kind of infrastructure, maintains this kind of infrastructure, becomes the military protector of the infrastructure, and most importantly, the arbiter of the whole system, the power that makes up the rules that make it all work. So if we look at this region of Eurasia and think of populations of billions of people, economic potentials that are just astounding, this is where the action is. And Afghanistan is at the very heart of that.
You have been listening to Capitalism is War, the first episode of the radio documentary series Capitalism is the Crisis.
Capitalism is the Crisis is dedicated to the memory of Ho Chi Minh.
This documentary was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. It was written in 2012 and produced in 2013. Go to www.asadismi.ws to download the series.
Theme music at the start of each episode is The Clash, London Calling, and at the end is Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb. This episode also features a song sung by Yanar Mohammed called Al Umalia, which is dedicated to Iraqi workers. The song was written by Iraqi activist Falah Alwan and calls for equality, freedom, and a workers' state in Iraq.
Thanks to Kevin Shaw for production assistance.
This documentary was funded by Canadian Union of Postal Workers National.
CUPW Local 576, North Bay.
Public Service Alliance of Canada.
Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation.
Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 3903.
Ed Finn.
Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association.
Thank you for listening.